and on higher education in British Columbia. Tonight, we are taking off into the realm of pure science, and the subject is particle physics. The lecturer will be Dr. Alan Asbury, who is one of the world's leading researchers in subatomic physics. Dr. Asbury was born in Liverpool, educated at school there, and then went on to the British universities, and eventually spent a large number of years working at the Rutherford Laboratory in England. It's near Harwell, I understand. And for the last 6 years, after I think some 3 years in California, he has been working at the European Center for Particle Physics. There, he's been the co-leader of a vast research project to discover a few dozen of elusive particles called W and Z. I am not sure what happened to X and Y, but these are, perhaps they aren't elusive. Now, this work has been successful, and in fact, they have found a number of particles, and he's going to tell us about the search for them and what he has found. This work and the result is, I'm told by my scientific friends, a milestone in the history of science. And we are fortunate indeed to have one of the people who have been involved in this to tell us about it. The University of Victoria and Triumph recently persuaded Dr. Asbury to come to British Columbia, and he's now a professor at the University of Victoria, holding a joint appointment with Triumph. He's a scientific member of the of Triumph's research staff. He moved to British Columbia during the past summer, bringing his family, and tonight we have not only the pleasure of having him here, but we have his wife and his wife's mother with him. We welcome them and hope they're happy and that Dr. Asbury's work here is as fruitful as it has been elsewhere. I'll now call on Dr. Asbury to teach us the ABCs of W and Z, the new particles and the new physics. Dr. Asbury.
Not sure how you get this to stay. It's going to be down too low.
Eric, how do you get this thing to stay?
He wants it to be up here, see?
Well, it's okay. Then.
Sure.
It'll be okay. Yeah, I've got a good one.
It has to go higher.
Clip it. Clip it.
Clip it.
Clip it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? Are you all through?
Will it be true?
Okay, thank you. Let me first of all say how pleased I am to be at your institute. I will try and tell you about the W and the Z. This is the... Can you see? Okay. The W and the Z, they're new particles on this transparency. In fact, they're fairly old particles, or at least they've been desired for a long time. They've actually had their properties specified for best part of 20 years, and they're newly discovered, and the new physics. Again, try and give you a feeling for some of the things that we have learned. I will try and split the talk into four pieces, give you a quick tour, and I apologize to my particle physics friends in the audience for how vague and inaccurate it will be, but try and give you a feeling for the present state of particle physics. Particle physics is that part of physics which is driven by the belief that you can go on dividing matter until you come to a small number of simple basic building blocks, and you can also understand how they interact with each other with a small number of forces. This would point why you would look for W and Z. Spend a few words on the machine aspects, because they were really, in a sense, quite outrageous and daring, how you might make W and Z. Then go through the UA1 detector. UA1 stands for nothing more than Underground Area Experiment Number 1. Not a terribly exciting title. It was actually chosen by Sir John Adams, who is, well, quite a conservative man, but UA1 is our title. I'll try and tell you how you might recognize the W and the Z if you see one, and then finish with some summary and conclusions. Let me first of all begin with a fairly outrageous mnemonic. It is Saturday evening after all, and if you remember nothing else from this talk, maybe you will remember the next transparency. Now, this lady is very obviously topless. It's not necessarily a lasting situation. She's also got lots of charm. If you look at it, it's fairly discreet as these things go. There's no sign of bare bottom. And in fact, with an old bicycle like this in a stream in flood, you could say she's exhibiting some guts. These are bad jokes, but by the end of the talk, you may begin to understand them, hopefully. Topless, lots of charm, no sign of bare bottom. Is there any guts? Right, now suppose we set ourselves the hypothetical task of building something, one of us, like the young lady. What would you need? You go to the stock room and you may say, you know, I need arms two off, legs two off, but the storeman may say, oh no, you need some atoms. You would say, well, do you mean atoms or do you mean molecules? And there may be a little discussion, and you would say, well, take water. So a lot of our body weight is in water. What does that look like if I keep breaking it down? If you keep breaking it down, it comes to two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom joined together. This is my water molecule. And in fact, at this level, you would say... You would say that I have reached already my fundamental building blocks. And in fact, you have for chemistry. You have the periodic table of chemistry. You start with the lightest element, hydrogen, and you go on through carbon, oxygen, which you all know. You go through uranium. There's about 106 or more of these things. But if you look at them, you see patterns of properties that are repeated. And this begins to suggest to you already that maybe these are not fundamental. They may be at the level of chemistry, but maybe you can go on. So if you take a closer look at this water, what do you see? Well, you see that it's made from atoms. And if you look at these atoms, you see that at the center of the hydrogen atom, you have the proton surrounded by an electron. You have two of these in water. And if you go to this oxygen, you find you'll have eight of these protons and eight neutrons at the central part, again, surrounded by electrons. The electrons are shared to some extent, and this, in fact, makes up your water molecule made from these atoms. And already you would say, well, these must be more fundamental than my atoms. So I have a picture of an atom, which is a nucleus surrounded by electrons. My nucleus is made up of protons with a positive charge, an uncharged neutron. I have around it an electron cloud, negatively charged. These are my building blocks, and indeed these were the building blocks of the 1930s. What about the forces? since we're interested in forces and economy and forces as well. Well, I obviously have to have an electromagnetic force. We all know the electromagnetic force. It's attractive between unlike charges. This is the force of chemistry and biology. But there must be something else, because these protons, which are positively charged, are somehow stuck together at the center of this atom, and they're stuck together very strongly. And this strong force is the driving force behind your nuclear fission and your nuclear fusion. Now, you must overcome that electromagnetic repulsion with the strong force, so we must have a second force. So if you go back to your building blocks now, you might say, well, okay, what I need in my stock room, I need some protons, I need some neutrons, and I need some electrons, and maybe that's it. However, if you put these things on your shelves, you would go to the box labeled neutrons. Every time you went to it, you would only find protons and electrons, because in the free state, this decays. It has a half-life of 15 minutes, but all the time, this free neutron becomes a proton and an electron. And if you measure precisely, you will find that there is also something missing. This electron doesn't always have an energy which is half of the mass of this neutron. It has somewhat less. And this led Pauli in the 1930s to postulate another particle, the neutrino. And it went for 20 years before this was actually directly detected in the late 50s. So I have a decay, and this decay gives me another force. It gives me the weak force, and it gives me the force that is responsible for radioactive decay. So maybe these are my building blocks, these are my forces. However, I know I can't keep this one in the free state. Now, in a nucleus, this decay doesn't take place. And it doesn't take place because there is nowhere for this proton to go, in a sense, in a stable nucleus. So the fact, in a way, that you are all sitting here this evening and not disappearing with a half-life of 15 minutes is due to what is known as the Pauli exclusion principle. There is nowhere for this proton to go in a stable nucleus. Make the neutron free, and it will decay by the weak force. Now, what about these forces? How do we envisage them, or how do we see them? And if you have a force, if you have an electron and another electron, how do they communicate with each other? Well, there is some kind of an exchange. This exchange cannot be faster than the velocity of light, but they communicate by exchanging what is called a quantum of the field. They exchange a particle. And for the electromagnetic interaction, they exchange what we know as the photon. Now, the photon has been around since the turn of the century. If you take a light wave, I'm sure most of you know that if you look at the energy in that light wave, it comes in discrete packets. This discrete packet is what is exchanged in the electromagnetic force. The nuclear force, this strong force that binds the nucleus, takes place over the very small region of the nucleus. If you need an exchange, you have to give it a mass. This was a contribution made by Yukawa, again in the 1930s, revolutionary at the time, and it's a concept that we hang on to right now through the W and the Z. This has to have a mass so that the force has a finite range. Basically and intuitively, if this proton needs, if you like, to summon up enough energy to transmit something across with its force, then the mass of this will somehow reflect. You could see it if you had to exchange something yourself. If it's heavier, the range won't be quite so far. And in fact, the pi meson was invented for just this reason. The weak force, the one that caused our neutrons to decay, that seemed to act at a point. And in fact, there was a very successful theory, again from the 30s, where you could calculate most things. The reason you could calculate most things was because you were looking at them at low energies. When you went to higher energies, you had problems. So maybe the weak force also has an exchange. But again, much more massive than this, because the range, as we know now, is very much smaller. So the mass of these exchange particles is related to the range of the force. And we had a specific prediction for the pi meson. Through the early part of this century through until 1940s and 50s, tremendous amount of particle physics research came from cosmic rays. These are nuclei that hit the top of the atmosphere. They produce particles, which you see down at sea level or at the tops of mountains. And in fact, as we sit here now, many cosmic rays stream through us every minute. In these cosmic rays, the Pi meson was found with roughly the right mass. Unfortunately, it brought with it an unwanted guest, in a sense, the mu meson. This mu meson just seemed to be like a heavy electron, and it also brought a whole host of what are called strange particles. These were particles in the cosmic rays which had very curious decays and earned the name of strange particles. So that if you wanted now to start classifying our blocks into which we've broken matter, we still have our proton and our neutron. We add our pion to it. We call these hadrons because they take part in the strong force. We give the name leptons to these other particles, the electron, the neutrino, the muon, which is the heavy brother of the electron, and its neutrino. And these indeed seem to represent what we might feel are elementary particles. And in fact, this was the situation with the advent of particle accelerators. Now, I don't want to go through this in detail, but just to give you a picture of what life got like, with the accelerators, you could actually make beams of these particles. For example, at Triumph down the road, you probably have the most intense beam of pions in the world. You could also have beams of strange particles. And then you could study how they interact. And then, in a sense, the slightly unexpected thing, in a way, happened, was that you found many particles. They didn't live as long as the neutron, or the proton, or the pion, but nonetheless, they were particles. They only lived as long as it took the light to cross the nuclear dimension, but they lived, and they were real particles. And there were hundreds of them, or almost hundreds of them. Now, it was very difficult to go on calling these elementary particles. On a basis, the neutron and the proton were no different from their friends, and these things started to group in multiplets. Very neat multiplets. The neutron is here, the proton. These are the strange particles that came out of cosmic rays. Here's our pion, more strange particles out of cosmic rays. Here's a multiplet of excited states. And it was in the middle 60s that it was realized that you could simplify all of this if you could build these particles out of quarks. This was a name given to them by Gell-Mann from Caltech. And in fact, you only needed three kinds, or three flavors, as we refer to them now, of quarks to build all this myriad of particles. You just needed an up quark, a down quark, and a strange quark. And that was all you needed. Those were your building blocks. Now, you had to swallow, in some sense, the fact that if you believe this proton had a positive charge, these did not have integer charge. And so initially, they were regarded a little bit as mathematical entities. They were things that you could explain the spectrum with, but maybe you could never actually see them. And as you will see towards the end, that may indeed still be the case. But what about our forces? Around the same period of time, in the 60s, we have our electromagnetic force and our weak force. This one, we believe, is mediated by our photon. It's massless. This one, it could be mediated by something which is extremely massive. Now, around this time, Weinberg and Salam suggested that maybe these were two manifestations of the same force. And the only reason you saw them with a different strength was because of the energy scale that you looked at them. So maybe if you went to a correct energy scale or a high enough energy scale, these two forces would have the same strength. Maybe this one was affected by a massive exchange, and in fact, you were looking at it on an energy scale where its strength was reduced by the mass squared of this exchange, and also, of course, if it's massive, it would be very short-ranged. So in fact, around about 74, we believed, at least on paper, there was a unified theory of weak and electromagnetic interactions. It put all these things, in a sense, on an equal criteria. This was massless. These two were massive, and it predicted a new exchange, the Z0. We had our building blocks. We had our up quarks and our down quarks, our electron and our neutrino. We had a strange quark, and we had a muon and its neutrino. But there was a gap here. Aesthetically, it didn't look nice. We had four of these. Why not four of these? Also, there was a kind of reaction predicted by this theory which experimentalists couldn't find. And it was then that Glashow proposed charm. One more quark that, if used correctly and put into this slot, could suppress the kind of reaction that his experimental colleagues couldn't find. And in 1974, at Stanford and at Brookhaven Lab on Long Island, charm indeed was found. So in a sense, that seemed to be it. We'd completed our building blocks, four of each. We had our unified forces, maybe, if we could see these things. And in fact, things in a sense looked great, except in 1975 at Stanford, they found another lepton, another heavier brother of the electron. 1977, another quark was found, given the name of bottom. Don't ask me why it was given the name of bottom, but it was. And these quarks were now becoming more real. They were not the mathematical entities, in a sense, before, because you were able to see them, at least in an indirect way. And the way you were able to see them was by using high-energy beams. If I look at, say, a nucleus with a high-energy beam of a certain wavelength, and the wavelength is related to the energy, I can see this nucleus. Now, if I raise my energy and I shorten my wavelength, I can see inside that nucleus, and I can actually see a nucleon. I can see a nucleon, or I can see a proton. If I can get to a high enough energy, I can go to an even shorter wavelength, and I can look inside this nucleon, and I can look and see what's inside, to see if it's uniform, to see if it's concentrated in pieces. And indeed, the interior of the proton or the neutron seemed to consist, if you like, of gritty little pieces, partons they were called, and indeed there are quarks, and there's another kind of them, as I'll mention shortly, but they behaved almost as if they were free in there. And so hadrons really seemed to be built from these peculiar particles, quarks. The proton, for example, two up quarks and a down quark. The neutron, an up quark and two down quarks. The lambda from strange particles, up, down, and a strange quark this time. Charm particles, up, down, and charm. It exhibited the quantum number of charm. Up, down, and the bottom quark, not yet seen. Charms been seen, several charm particles seen. There's a very large spectrum of these particles, but, and this is the thing which is different on this occasion, we seem unable to get these quarks out from a nucleon. They're the building blocks, they work as the building blocks, they give us our spectrum, you can see them with the high energy. If you try and knock them out of a nucleon, all you get is a jet of conventional particles. You can take a proton from a nucleus, you cannot, or you have not been able so far, to knock one of these particles out of a nucleon. You now begin to see the strong force, the force that binds the nucleus, in a different scenario. You see it now as the force between these quarks, and you see it as an exchange between, say, a down quark and an up quark. So if we now go to our full scenario of forces, excluding, and I've left it out deliberately, gravity, which is a very, very weak force on this scale and completely negligible, but again, one you feel because it has a long range. The forces now act between the quarks and the leptons. So you have the electromagnetic force between, say, up quarks and electrons with this photon exchange. You can have the force of the neutron decay between quarks, and in fact what happens in the neutron is one of the down quarks becomes an up quark, and my neutron becomes a proton, and it exchanges this very massive W. And the strong interactions, there was another exchange invented, the gluon. The gluon was the particle that was exchanged between the quarks, And when you look at the nuclear force in a nucleus, you see, in a way which is not easy to calculate and not understood, a manifestation of this more fundamental force. We had seen these unified in a theory, and the theory had predicted a W and a Z, and we already had the photon. And there was a suggestion, and this theory looked extremely elegant, that if you could unify these forces, if these had equal strengths at some energy, why not, in a grand unification, put all three forces together? And then, of course, ultimately, maybe you could include gravity and have all of nature's four forces, the four facets of one force. But that's very ambitious and a long way off. Our building blocks now were, again, our quarks and leptons, up and down, electron and neutrino, charmed and strange, muon and its neutrino, bottom, the tau lepton, its neutrino. Top was missing, and top is still missing, and it's not yet been found. So if you believe in this nice, neat picture, you're looking for six quark flavors. They're the things that have the strong interaction. They also have the weak and the electromagnetic. And you have six leptons, which in fact only enjoy the weak and the electromagnetic force. Now, to give you a feeling for what would be involved in going to look for W's and Z's, and in fact, there were many indications that this unified theory was correct, but in a sense, really, the telling way of seeing if it was correct was to actually produce these things in the laboratory, identify them in the laboratory, measure their properties, and see if they agreed with the theory. High energy physics works on this equality of, if you like, energy and mass, the old Einstein equation. Our energy unit is the electron volt. If I take my electron and I put it through a potential of 1 volt, I get an electron volt. That's my unit of energy. It's a very small unit. We work in millions of them, or we work in thousands of millions of them. And in fact, on this scale, the electron has a mass of half an MeV. The proton has a mass of almost 1 GeV, 0.938. This theory predicted that my W and my Z would have masses of 82 and 94 GeV, almost, with the Z0 exactly, 100 times the mass of the proton, which up to now, in a sense, was the heaviest stable object we'd been playing with. So you would have to go to very high energies to produce these particles. Now, if you wanted to make them in the laboratory, how would you go about it? Well, you have plenty of high-energy beams around. Suppose you take one of these high-energy beams and you smash it into a target, which also has in it neutrons and protons. Can I produce one of these Ws? X here is not a particle. It just stands for all the rest that comes out of this reaction. I would have a proton-proton. It would give me a proton and a proton in the final state. Maybe I could produce a W. Now, if you look at what happens if this target is stationary, it's a very inefficient way of using the energy. Because if I make something massive here, I can't make it at rest, because I have momentum that comes in, which I have to conserve. So I have to use up some of my precious energy in making this thing move to balance the momentum. Much better if I could collide a target and a beam head on. Why head on? Because I would have no momentum in the initial state. I could take all of the energy of these beams and convert it into something massive, which would sit there still, and I could make a heavy particle. So in a way, the trick to get to higher energies is to use colliding beams. Now, at CERN, which is the European Center for Research near Geneva, it's a laboratory funded by 12 European member states, has an annual budget of something like 620 million Swiss francs, $300 million. There was an accelerator, the proton, super proton synchrotron. It spent all its time accelerating particles from 10 GeV to 400 GeV, protons. You put them in. The ring is about 6 kilometers around, 2.2 kilometers in diameter. Every few seconds, you inject particles at 10 GeV. accelerate them to 400 GeV, kick them out of the machine onto stationary targets, and make beams for experiments. Now, suppose, and I only have a single ring of magnets sitting some 30 to 60 meters below ground in a tunnel, suppose I could find something that would go around that ring the opposite way. And what would I need? Well, I would need an antiproton. And the antiproton is exactly the same as the proton, but with all its properties reversed. And on this occasion, the most telling one is the charge. So to the accelerator physicists, protons going around in this direction are in some sense, or to the electrical engineer, shall we say, indistinguishable from antiprotons going around in this direction. This was a telling argument used by Carlo Rubbia, who pushed this product. If you can send protons around it one way, you can surely send antiprotons around it the other way. But how do you get the antiprotons? The protons are easy. You go to a gas bottle, you open the tap of a hydrogen bottle, and out come your protons. This is not so obvious. We live in a world which does not have antimatter in it, naturally. You have to make these, and you have to make them in another accelerator. More than that, you have to store them. And even more than that, you have to increase their density in space until you can put them into the guide fields and the RF, radio frequency, guide of this machine. So you have to produce antiprotons, store them, accumulate them, and in fact the technique is called cooling. You have to increase their density in space before you can put them in the machine. And all of these things had to be achieved. And in fact, you have to produce and accumulate these things for around 24 hours before you have enough to put into the big machine to give you something approaching a decent interaction rate. So what we as the experimenters faced was an accumulation period of 24 hours, and then we hoped a collision period of 15 hours, there or thereabouts. And of course, all the time during these 15 hours, you're at the mercy of the French electricity supply. If it bleeps or glitches, you lose your beam and you have a day wait for the next filling. To give you, I won't go through all of this, but just to give you some idea of how skillful the accelerator physics was, you took a beam from this machine, you produced your antiprotons here, you stored them in this machine for 24 hours, then you took them back round the bypass into this one, going the wrong way round because they were antiprotons, and you sent them over to the 6 kilometer machine where already you had protons waiting for them. And these machines are kilometers apart, and these particles have to arrive within a few thousand experiment. If I have my proton and my antiproton, and in fact the energy was 270 GeV, where you could make the magnet go into a DC state, how would I recognize that I'd ever made a W in these collisions, or a Z for that matter? What you were seeing, since you believe this was made out of quarks, and what you were looking for was a collision between the constituents, between the quark in the proton and the antiquark in the antiproton. So I was looking for, say, a W minus, made out of an antiquark, all the quarks have their antis, and a down, and I was looking for its decay. Now, this particle, the W, again, lives a very short time. You have no chance of seeing it in a detector. All you can see are its decay products and infer that you've produced it. If it goes to these quarks, we've already said they're not really allowed out in some sense, you would just see jets of particles. But you would also see jets of particles from the two that had collided, because you'd taken out of them one of their constituents. And so you would expect to see events with four jets. That could be a very characteristic signature in a detector. However, unfortunately, you're making these things through the weak interaction, admittedly boosted in strength by the energy. But the strong interaction is scattering these things off each other as well. So you have many events with four jets, and you have no chance of seeing it in that way. Fortunately, 8% of the time, this W decays into my well-known electron and my neutrino. And here you may have a chance. If this thing were at rest, and it broke into two particles, it decayed. You would expect the energy of the electron to equal the energy of the neutrino and to be half the mass of this W. They would share the mass. It isn't quite at rest, but it's close. And what I would see is an electron going off, say to one side, but then to the other side I have a neutrino. Now this neutrino, it has been detected, but on an event-by-event basis, they're essentially undetectable. So what I would see is an event where I have an electron, but I don't see anything on this side, but it's energetic, it's got half the mass of this W, so I would have an event where I don't balance momentum and energy. And if I look transverse across the beams, I'm going to be missing this neutrino. So if I can make myself a detector where I can pick up all of the energy of the collisions and I can see the electron, then I can infer that I've had a neutrino by some missing energy. And I can also work out the direction of the missing energy. And since I'm coming from one body to two, they had better line up. And so what the experimentalist is looking for, he's looking for events with electrons, which you can see and identify, associated with a lot of missing energy. And so what the experimentalist does, he plots his number of events against the transverse energy for, say, the electron, and he expects to see a peak somewhere near half the mass of the W. And if I can do that for this missing energy, if my detector is good enough, maybe I'll see another peak. And then I'm really there if these two things occur at the same time. I then can say I've seen a particle, and I've seen another one, because I've seen the energy that it took away. And that was the principle in which we looked for the W. The Z is, in a sense, easier. It also splits into two quarks, four jets, we have many events. But 3% of the time, this goes to a pair of electrons. Here, I can see both these particles. I can measure everything about these particles, so I can reconstruct this mass. And we already knew that from the discovery of Charm and from the discovery of Bottom, that this was a very telling handle. You could pick out a needle in one of these enormous haystacks by measuring both these final state particles. So my experimentalist would plot my events, and I would expect a little tiny cluster around the mass of the Z, around 90 GeV. There weren't many of them. They're not easy to find. If I have my cycle that I described to you of 24 hours accumulation, running for 15 hours every day, roughly, mostly at night and through the night, unfortunately, I used to have one, or I could expect one of these every 15 hours, there or thereabouts. The Z0, not so frequent. If I managed to do this 7 days a week, 7 nights a week, maybe I would see one of these a week. And that was the kind of odds that you face to look for these particles. The actual interactions in this detector were taking place at roughly 4,000 a second. So you had somehow, in the face of this, identify one a week when you had potentially staring you in the face 4,000 per second. So indeed it was a needle in a very large haystack. In principle, how would you do it? Or a schematic detector? Well, if I have a proton and an antiproton, I would first of all like to see what happens in this collision. I would like to see the tracks of these particles as they leave the collision. And so we have around the collision point a large gaseous volume, and as these particles go through it, they leave tracks of electrons, and these electrons drift to wires in that volume. And by measuring the time, you can play back the picture of these charged tracks. Now, that isn't the whole story, unfortunately. Remember, I'm trying to collect all of the energy in these collisions to see if it balances. A third of what comes out of these collisions is neutral. It just goes through my gas and doesn't do anything. So around it, you have to put what we call calorimeters. All these are pieces of matter with sensitive regions in them. You force the neutral particles to interact, you measure the light that they produce in this instance, and you measure their energy. So you see your charged particles in the central part of the detector, and you see the rest of the energy in the calorimeters, which you try and put completely around the interaction region. This is the collision plane. Here you have the beam's eye view of the detector, and you try it again in here. More than that, if I could put a magnetic field on this central region, I could make the particles have curved tracks, I could see the sign, and I could measure the momentum. Also, some of these interactions produce a muon. Now, on these occasions, the muon is extremely friendly. It goes right out through all this material, and this is meters of iron and lead, and it appears on the outside of the detector, and I can tell I've got a muon, just because it made it through all this material. So this was the principle of the UI1 detector. What was UA1? Well, the cast of UA1 was about 130 physicists. They came from 12 institutes scattered around the world: Annecy in France, Aachen in Germany, Birmingham in the UK. We had CERN physicists, a lot of CERN support, College de France in Paris, Helsinki, Queen Mary College London, Riverside, University of California, Rome, Rutherford Lab UK, Saclay in Paris and Vienna. 12 institutes, 130 physicists, probably as many engineers and technicians during the building of the experiment, and probably as many as this 130 working on the accelerator project. This detector probably cost 35 million Swiss francs, just one detector, and that's not salaries, just the hardware. And that must be added to the accelerator complex and the experimental hall, which was something like 120 million Swiss francs. So it was an expensive project, a big project. And let me give you an artist's impression of what the real detector looked like. Here you see the man. This is the man. This is my central detector, 6 meters long, 2.4 meters in diameter, full of gas and wires to try and see my particles. Around it, my calorimeters. I have a magnetic field, and outside of it, I have my muon detectors. This whole central part of the experiment, somewhere like 2,500 tons, and moved in and out of the beam on this very big boxcar. When we were not using the machine, about 1,000 other physicists were jumping all over us, wishing to get back onto their accelerator. So we had our detector so that we could get it out in roughly 8 hours if we had to, if it went wrong. Just to give you a sort of mechanical view in some sense of the detector to show that we made it, well, if I'd have drawn the schematic unlike the real detector, it would have been sort of stupid. So this is the real detector, central detector, electromagnetic calorimeter, hadron calorimeter, and muon chambers. Proton, antiproton. We continued the calorimetry down the beam lines all the way to within a fraction of a degree to the beam. And also, we wrapped it all the way around the beam in this direction. Here the beam is going into and out of the paper. Again, as you go out in layers, it's like an onion, the central detector, calorimeters, and the muon chambers. Now, what did we see when these things collided? Well, let me show you a picture from the central detector. This is a collision. It's just an ordinary collision. It's nothing special. You can see that there's been a vertex in the middle. The proton and the antiproton have hit each other. And you see these curved tracks, the charge tracks that leave the interaction region. And the color is, in a sense, not just for effect. The color gives you the depth, so that you go all the way from red to violet, depending upon how deep you are through the chamber. I found it incredibly difficult to read, but it gives you very pretty pictures, in fact. So this is an interaction in the center of the detector. Sometimes, of course, the beam collided with one of the gas molecules that remained in the vacuum vessel of the machine. And then, of course, there was no mistaking it. You got a completely different picture. Here, somewhere upstream of the detector, you've hit a gas molecule, or you've hit one of the protons in this atom in it, to be more precise, and you see nothing like the original picture. So there's no difficulty in picking out the fact that you've had collisions. But how much difficulty is there in picking out W's? Well, let me show you one of the favored ways, if you like, or the obvious ways of looking for a W. You would see many events like this. Here you can see the purple tracks. The tracks that are put in white are in fact the tracks in a jet. You can see that there's a cluster of almost straight tracks, and this is one of the events where I have my fragments of my proton and my antiproton, and I have two jets in the event. And there are a lot of events of this nature. This is how we see quarks. The only way, unfortunately, that we see them. We see jets of particles. We can learn more from this detector about these jets because we can also display the information from the calorimeters. And this is, in fact, a display which shows you the cells of the calorimeters that have been struck. Again, two jets, some forward jets, but two jets in the center of the detector. I have all the energy information from the whole of the detector in this picture. How would I see a W? Well, this is the first W. One Sunday morning, one of the young postdoctoral fellows in the experiment came rushing up in the corridor and said, "I think we have the first one." And this was it, and in fact he was right. We'd had a few false alarms before that, which even reached the west coast of America, but this was the first real W. And what you see is an interaction here. There are 65 charged tracks, but you see this long, stiff track, which has a very high momentum. The arrow points to it. And in fact, if I do the energy budget on these tracks, I have a lot of energy missing, and it's exactly opposite in direction to this track. This, again, is a historic event. You probably can't see it or you won't notice it, but this, in fact, is the first Z0 event ever found. And the way that you recognize that from this detector, it's hard to see, but it's this very stiff track and this very stiff track, which in the calorimeters have all the appearance of an electron. If you reconstruct the mass, they come from a Z0, which was produced in the collision. This event, found by a young French girl in the collaboration who was linked to the computer by her telephone. In Annecy, she saw this on a printout, 3 o'clock in the morning, drove all the way to Geneva at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then called us all around 7. And on the counting room door was a nice picture of this event, and she'd written across it unashamedly, "The first Z0 in the world." And in fact, it turned out to be correct. Now, you can see these events rather better. These look pretty, but in a sense, if you get serious with the detector, here I have all the tracks and all my calorimeter cells in an event. Again, it's a Z0 event. But now, if I say, well, I won't look at all the things that haven't had a hard collision. I won't look at all the things that haven't been hit hard in the transverse plane to the beam. I'll cut them out. Don't show them to me in the picture. And what remains is the bottom picture. Only the two decay products from the Z0. So in fact, you can pick them out, and you can pick them out very cleanly. If you make this simple cut to these events, you clean out all of the background, and you're left with just the Z0. You can do exactly the same with events which are muons. Here, you have a muon event. It's this track, and it's this very straight track here. If I go to the rather more useful picture, which is, these are public relation pictures in some sense, the ones that we used in the experiment. Here again, I have everything on this picture, including these muons that came right out through the detector. Here, I ask some modest cut transverse to the beam. I'm left with one muon, another muon, and a little bit of activity here. There is a small jet on this event. Again, it cleans up, and you're left with a very clean signature. So in fact, you can pick out very cleanly the events from our haystack. And in fact, if you remember, you said that we said we would wrap our detector right around it, we would see our electron, and from all the energy that we detected, we'd try and induce where this neutrino went. And these are the first five events of 1983 that led to the W discovery. They all, if the electron is in this direction, they all point in the opposite direction, and they all have roughly half the energy of the Z, not quite, because the of the W rather. The W is not quite at rest. And these were the five events that were put as the W discovery. Now, of course, we have a lot more, and the picture stays the same. 43 events. Again, they always point opposite to the electron, and they always share the W with the electron. You remember we said if our detector was good enough and we plotted the energy of these things, we would see a peak. These are the 43 events from the run of this year. Here I have my peak. This is what it would look like if I have a W to an E plus a neutrino. If my detector is really good and I can add up my energy and do my budgeting correctly, maybe I can even detect particles by their absence and do the same thing for neutrinos. And this, in fact, it says missing transverse energy. It's really the neutrino transverse energy. And again, you can see something of a peak. These are my W's. If I put together all my Z's, then of course it's a lot cleaner. All I have to do is reconstruct the mass, and here, of course, you can see how tightly they cluster around the mass of the Z, including the muon event, which is not so well measured. And there's nothing in here. This is the threshold. This could be full, but there's nothing. Just these events that sit out here at this mass. So in fact, the results which came from the experiment, in January, we had our five W's. In June, we had six Z's, four electron pairs, two muon pairs. Now we have eight Z's, and in fact, there are 53 W's. And the properties have been looked at now. They look like the weak, you can do checks on them, they look like the quantum of the weak field. There is a second experiment, which in some sense, well, doesn't really get ignored. They make sure they don't get ignored, but let me not ignore them, called UA2, originally enough. They have eight Z's and 35 W's. In some sense, the CERN management hedged its bets and put in two horses, and both have found W's and Z's. We have a mass here, 80.9, plus minus 1.5. There's some scale uncertainty. Theory says 83, plus minus 2.8. We have a mass of the Z, 95.6, plus minus 1.4. Theory says 93. So these things show up remarkably close to their theoretical predictions. This is the UA1 experiment. This is the combined unified weak theory of Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow. So you don't have many, but they occur with exactly the right properties. So now, to close, let me show you some pictures of the UA1 detector. This is, in fact, a view of CERN. Do I just press this thing? I don't see it. Oh, press it for, okay.
Yes.
Right, thanks. Okay. This is the CERN laboratory. This is the main highway in towards Geneva, which sits here. These are the Alps. This is the Salève behind Geneva. This is one of the CERN accelerators. The one that we were using actually ran through this countryside all around here. There was an arc below ground here. And in fact, the French-Swiss border is somewhere round about here. So the machine passes from one to the other. You have to pass these particles across the frontier in some sense. This is the accelerator. Here you see the tunnel, some 30 to 60 meters underground. You can see the slight curvature of the 6-kilometer ring. Here you see the guide bending magnets, which bend the particles around. They're inside a vacuum vessel, which is inside these magnets. And this, as I say, around this, the particles go something like 50,000 times a second. They're moving at the velocity of light. Clearly, if you want to do an experiment 30 meters down, then the first thing you do is you have to dig a large hole to find the accelerator. And in fact, the geometry was to dig a shaft, which we used as our garage, and then dig a second shaft alongside it, which we used for the experiment. Here you can see the shaft, which is 30 meters deep and about 10 meters across, already being shored up. This is the narrower opening through which the detector had to pass to go into a ring that was here where we saw the collisions. So this was our garage, or the beginning of it, and around here we would have another hole for the interaction region. Here you see an aerial photograph. You're just looking down into the hole, which is the garage. The interaction region would be here, and the machine is coming in an arc round through here. This is the region beneath which we did the experiment. There was a roof put over it, of course, and shielding put back on. It was drilled from the surface. Here you just see the roof being put on. And here, I think, you can see a view of that dome. And this is the end of the experimental hall in which UA1 was assembled and lowered into the other pit, which is beyond. So we did the experiment beneath here, and we assembled in the inside the hall. This is the view inside the cavern where we did the experiment. We're now beneath the dome. Here you can see the accelerator tunnel. There is another opening here. So the actual experiment has to go into this gap when the civil engineering is finished. This is a view of the area as it stands today. You can see the green grass has grown over the UA1 experiment. The hole is here. This is the experimental hall. This is the local counting rooms, and this sits in the countryside, something like a couple of kilometers from CERN. This, I just show you, is the only new accelerator, but a very fancy one, built by CERN for the project. This is, in fact, where the antiprotons were accumulated. And in fact, it was a very impressive project. It went very quickly. Particles were kept in this ring for a month without any loss, or at least without any glitch that lost them. They were added to, particles were taken out, but some of the particles lasted in this ring for 1 month. Here you see the beginning of the UA1 detector. This, in fact, is one of the calorimeters. This is the iron of the magnet, and you can see it comes in 5 centimeter slices. And between it, we put these active pieces to detect the light from particles which shower in it. We take this away and turn it into an electrical impulse here, into a current pulse. This is part of the magnet, or the hadron calorimeter. These things are something like 6 meters. They were pre-assembled on this chariot, and you can see the magnet is half assembled at this point. Here, it's fully assembled with the end caps for the calorimeter, and we mapped the magnetic field. We needed to know it extremely precisely so that we could measure the momentum very precisely. And this was all done in the CERN laboratory, away from the area, before we installed. The components of the magnet were shipped sitting on their ends, and then they had to be turned upright. And this, in fact, was one of the first crises in UA1. Someone somewhere had lowered the crane height by 80 centimeters, and the first time we tried to turn one of these things, or the technicians, the crane was not high enough. So we had to dig a deeper hole in the floor. That was the only quick solution to get these things upright so that we could, in fact, get them down the hole like this. So this is at the top of the 30-meter shaft, which is the garage. Here you see them at the bottom of the shaft, the second one being put in place. There were 16 of them altogether, 8 on one side, 8 on the other, which make up the magnet. This is the coil of the magnet. If I put 10,000 amps, which is the current we had through this, then I can get a magnetic field over this very large volume. 7 meters by 3.5 meters by 3.5 meters. The story always was that if we'd have had a reasonable sized group, we could have held a group meeting in the magnet, but we didn't have a reasonable sized group, unfortunately. Here you see again the magnet. You get a feeling for the size, And you begin to see the calorimeters. These are the curved inner calorimeters, and here is one of the end calorimeters. So the detector is getting into a fairly advanced state by now. This is the way we calibrated the calorimeters. We had a very strong 4-curie cobalt radioactive source, which we shone at these calorimeters and mapped them and kept the energy calibrated. Because remember, we were having to do a budget on the missing energy and also measure the mass of these objects. Here we have jumped to the central detector, and you can see this is 1/6 of the central detector. You can see the arc, and you can see the wires being strung. This was a very clever device. You took this piece of nylon-like material, you preformed it to the shape of a part of a cylinder, you put the wires in, and if you'd got it all right, when you'd finished, you could just take it away from the preformer. It was completely held by the wires. It's sort of a bow and arrow principle, if you like. This shell, in fact, was made by Aerospatiale, the French aircraft firm that made Concorde. And this was also fairly expensive, actually. Here you see one of the covers of the central detector. Again, you get a feeling. This is roughly only 1/6 of the detector, which is filled with gas and something like 6,000 wires, to show you those pretty pictures. Here you can see half of the detector, the top half. You can see all the electronics that went on it. This is where the high voltage was fed in, and where all these cables and signals were taken away, and then taken away to the control room. So this is half of the detector, the upper half, in fact, three pieces. Here you can see the covers on that half of the detector, just to protect it. And again, you can see the services that went in down these channels, 6 meters long, 2.4 meter diameter. Here you can see the slightly hair-raising journey from CERN, the 2 kilometers to the detector, trouble with overhead wires to get this thing beneath it and to get it safely to UA1's experimental area. And here you can see it being lowered into the experiment, lowered from the crane, which is some 30 meters above, down to sit, and you can see the end calorimeter here in the center of the experiment. We have one or two more views. You can see the same. This is the bottom half of the detector from beneath. Here you begin to get the picture of the UA1 detector, central detector. The magnet is open to get it in. The beams went in down these tubes, an antiproton beam this end, proton beam at the other end. What happened, this was closed up. The whole thing moved into the experimental, into the machine. The machine coupled into these pipes, and that was, in fact, we took the vacuum system with us in the center of this detector. This, again, is a proton's eye view of the detector. The protons went in here, central detector, calorimeters all around it. This is, in fact, in the ring, and here you see some of the forward calorimetry. You may not recognize this, but this is looking down into the garage. This is looking up from 30 meters around the edge of the garage pit. What you see here is the control room, which had in it all of the electronics that was used to process the signals from this device. 2 floors of it, coupled by these cables to the detector. So that when we moved, the detector moved, this went flat, and then this room moved across the floor, put the shielding in, and so there was shielding between you and the detector when the detector was in the ring. Here you can see the catwalks by which you get down to the control room. Another view from up above, central detector, the magnet is open. It's again in the garage. You can see the blue catwalks to get down to it. This is one of the few experiments where actually doing things on the apparatus is physically hazardous in a way. You're 10 meters from the ground if you're working on top of this detector. So if you have to change anything, you need young people in the experiment, actually. a view from the back of the experiment, and again you can see all of the connections that go in. Here is the detector rolled in beneath the dome. You get the size from these men. This is the back of the magnet. The aim with this ducting to carry these cables was, of course, there were many thousand, probably 30 or 40,000 connections to the detector. Each one, when made initially, had to be made sure that it was not a short, that it was not an open circuit, that you got the signal that you expected. Once done, you never wished to break that connection. And so you could move this detector in and out and never break any of these signal connections. And that, in fact, it would have been impossible any other way. And also, you never broke any of the signal connections that went between our local control room and the computers which were up on the ground level. Again, for the same reason, it would have been impossible if you'd have broken these connections. So the cables were carried on booms, and they followed the apparatus backwards and forwards. These are the muon chambers. And again, I show them to you to show you the scope of the experiment. Here you see a man working on a pre-assembled plane of muon chambers. They were made out of extruded aluminium channel in here, and there was more than 50 kilometers in length of this channel. There was something like 500 square meters of muon chamber or more. And here you see them in the experiment. So they closed the box of UA1, and they look for these precious muons that came out, so on. So it's a difficult experiment to work on. The reason it's confined is, of course, that the area, 30 meters underground, is expensive. It costs you something like a million Swiss francs per meter as you go down in this area. So, to conclude then, let me give you a summary of the project. It was a proposal in 1976 by Carlo Rubbia. He convinced the CERN management that it could be done. He did most of the accelerator calculations himself. And in fact, he was right, it could be done. I think Carlo could convince almost anybody of anything. In fact, it's one of his gifts, one of his many gifts, in fact. 1977 to 1978, there were a lot of machine experiments. You had to show that you could, in fact, produce, collect, and cool these antiprotons. Another CERN physicist, Simon van der Meer, there's the accelerator genius who, in fact, in 1968 had invented the cooling technique, but he never published it until 1972. And in fact, he really put it to use between 77 and 78 on this project. 1978, we were approved, our experiment and the accelerator. And in 1981, we saw the first collisions in July. In November and December of the same year, we had our first physics run, and then we waited a whole year. UA1 had a terrible experience through that year. In getting ready for a run in the spring, there was a mistake made by the vacuum group, an excellent group of people, but everyone makes mistakes, and they blew dust all over our central detector. So we had to take the experiment to pieces, clean it, put it back together, and we did not run until October, November. In January, we had found five events, the five events that you'd seen, and we announced the W. Our colleagues in UA2 also had three or four events. We ran again in April with more intensity, no Z0s in this first run, not enough intensity. We had a long physics run through the beginning of this year, April to July. And in June, we had evidence for the Z0. We had six events, the ones you've seen clustered in mass, four electron events, two muon events. So this is the summary of the timetable of the experiment. And in fact, what can we say about the physics summary? Well, this unified model of weak and electromagnetic interactions looks to be in good shape. It's the so-called standard model at the moment. The W and the Z turned up with just their right masses. And in fact, the standard model seems to be okay. It's a very elegant theory. The question you can ask is, could it be extended in a way to include the strong interactions? There are some features which are not so elegant. How do these particles get their mass? And in a sense, it's fed in from the outside in the theory. It's fed in such a way that if the theory is correct as it stands, there is still to be found one particle. There's more, maybe, but this one, if you could find it, would be the key that this theory is really on the right track. We don't know the mass of this particle. We don't know its key decay modes. So in a sense, as experimentalists, our theoretical colleagues have given us nothing like the prescription that we had for the W and the Z. Can you extend this unification to the strong interaction? Well, this would be the guts, the grand unified theory or theories, which may in fact not only unify weak and electromagnetic, but also include the strong interaction. There are models. They make some predictions. The energy scale is horrendously large. There may be some consequences. Maybe the proton decays. To give you a feeling for the lifetime, if you take something like 3 tons of water and you watch it for a whole year, maybe one proton in it will decay. So this is the kind of experiment that you have to do, and is being done, in fact, deep underground, to see if you can see proton decay, to see if you can get a feeling for the next energy scale on which we might unify the 3 interactions. Gravity, for the moment, we push to one side. That would be the next stage. Our building blocks seem to be our quarks, up and down, charm and strange. We remain without top. Where is it? No one's found it yet. Everyone believes it's there. A lot of people are looking for it. We have no explanation, really, for why our leptons don't experience the strong force. And also, you begin to get the slightly sinking feeling that these things are repeating themselves, rather. Are these really the fundamental blocks? We have 3 generations, as they're called. Maybe there are more. But again, there are experiments you can do to measure that. All of our physics seems to be up and down in these generations. In the quarks, there are transitions in this direction. In the lepton world, there are no transitions in this direction, or at least very rare transitions. And in fact, there is a triumph experiment looking for just these transitions, transitions from muons to electrons, transitions in this horizontal direction, which in fact has a sensitivity on a mass scale much higher than the W and Z. But of course, it's a very speculative experiment. What we have done, in a sense, is the obvious experiment. You go and look for these things in the laboratory. The big question, of course, is if these are a building blocks, why doesn't nature allow us to see them in the laboratory? We can see the leptons. We know the leptons. We've maybe got more than we wanted, but at least we can see them. Why do we have to keep these quarks inside the hadrons? There are ideas why this is so, but in a sense, this is conceptually difficult. Your building block, you believe it's there, you feel you know it's there, but you can't get it out to see it in the laboratory, at least not up to now. And I think at that stage, I will thank you, and I've overrun slightly.
We will have some questions now. We don't have a great deal of time after our lectures for questions, so I would remind you that we can't have speeches, we can only have questions. And I would ask you to have one question per person to give everyone who wants to ask a question a chance. So let's not have 3 or 4 questions one after the other. Are we ready for the first question? The very back.
Did you know about the 10% rate of detectable decay of the W and Z before you went into the experiment?
Yes.
Would you repeat the question?
The question is, did we know about the percentage, did we know, in fact, how frequently the W went into to the lepton pair in some sense? The answer is yes, you knew it from the theory. you can calculate it from the theory, and it in fact depends on the number of those generations that you see. So you knew that number fairly well. So in fact, you knew a lot of numbers well. You knew roughly how probable it was to produce a W. You knew how probable it was that it would decay in the way that you were looking for. And in fact, you knew what the decay products were and the mass. So as I say, we had a good prescription, but faced with the number that you had to sift it out from, you needed it. I mean, but yes, you knew all of those things. But, well, you knew them if theory was right, and it seems to have been right.
One question.
Is a nuclear binding force a variable?
I'm not quite sure I understand you.
Is the nuclear binding force a variable? You said the force constants vary with the energy.
Well, the nuclear binding force, of course, is... yes, in a sense, its strength is a variable. It depends on how you look at it. If you look at it, for example, take the nuclear force as the force between the quarks, for example. The best way of seeing the nuclear force, or the best analogy I can give you, is, in a sense, if you take the three quarks in a proton and you somehow envisage them on the end of an elastic band, each one. If they're close together, then the elastic band is slack and the force, in a sense, is somewhat weak. Now, if you try and hit one of those hard and pull it out, the more you pull, the more you feel that elastic band, and the harder it is to get it out. So to that extent, the strong force inside the nucleons is a variable. And that is quite a good analogy, because when the band breaks, you still don't have your particle out. You still have something on the end of an elastic band in the nucleon. So it depends on how you look at it, and it does have a variable strength.
60 years ago, the leading scientist, physicist, seemed to think that if we understood fundamental matter better, it would be very simple. And most of the discoveries back in early 30s and 20s seemed to support that it was a simplification taking place. And they say, yes, we told you so. Now, it seems to me now that it looks to be getting, if you understand nature, fundamental matter, it will be getting more and more complicated, and there's going to be no end to the complications.
No, in a sense... The question was... The question was really, if some years ago you felt that you could in fact go back to building blocks and you would have a simple picture. It looks, the questioner says to him, as if that isn't the case anymore. The picture you're getting is getting more complicated. As far as the forces go, then of course we've known for a long time that we've had four forces. We've had the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, the weak force, and the strong force. Now the aim, and it's a desire or an aim, is maybe those are four facets of one force. Maybe that's a hope. But with unifying the weak and the electromagnetic in a rather elegant theory, maybe you're pointing the direction to go one more step, as I pointed out, to put the strong in there. So now at least you've got two of nature's forces together in one theory and an indication of how you might go for the third. It's not going to be easy, but you at least have a framework, and that's been confirmed in a sense by these experiments at CERN. So you've dropped in a way one force. You're now left with three. You've a long way to go, but you've taken the first step maybe. As far as the constituents go, then I would say things are at a slightly difficult stage. You know quite a lot about the quarks and the leptons. You know how many there are. There's a symmetry in the numbers of them. But in a way, there's more, you feel, than you would like for the fundamental blocks. Now, there are experiments and there are accelerators that will happen within the next, I don't know, certainly less than the next decade, that will tell you if these things are indeed elemental. Maybe they are made of something else, which is simpler. And there are quite a lot of people that believe that that is the case, that maybe the quarks and leptons are in fact made up of some building block at the next stage, but at the moment we're not aware of, the energies have not been high enough to look at it, and that would in fact simplify things. The thing which is conceptually difficult now for a lot of us is that you can't have these things in the laboratory. They only exist inside these hadrons. And so some people say, well, maybe that's nature's warning. Maybe you've gone far enough. You can't get them out. There's nothing more. But there are experiments that will look at these things.
Dr. Volt?
Alan, in this experiment, you've got lots of computer tapes with probably lots of things people want to look at. Is there any possibility that in all those tapes you have somewhere buried the top quark?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's it probably is buried. It almost certainly is on the tapes. The question is whether you can find a sufficiently characteristic signature to convince yourself and your colleagues that you have it. I mean, probably even Saturday night, tonight in Geneva, I'm sure there are young people working, looking for the top quark. I would be very surprised if there are not. In our data, yes.
And I don't mean to be funny, but if you're looking for smaller particles, the apparatus is getting larger and larger. I'm afraid you're going to run out of room.
But the question was, we're looking for smaller and smaller things with bigger and bigger pieces of apparatus. Yes, in a sense, I have some sympathy with what, and with bigger and bigger groups of people, actually. That's another thing which must be added. There are experiments now which dwarf our experiment. There are experiments twice the size of ours. I mean, that would be difficult. But to answer your question, the UA1 apparatus, I don't say it couldn't be smaller, but there are certain things that you can only measure to a certain precision, and this, in a sense, determines the size. I mean, you take this big central detector. It was 6 meters long, 2.4 meters in diameter, and it sat in a magnetic field. Now, what you wanted from it was a precise measurement of the curvature of a track of momentum. Now, it turns out, in a volume of that size, and by timing electron drift, you can really only measure to about 200 microns. Now, only 200 microns, you say, that's a fifth of a millimeter, but that's about it. Now, if you want to measure a track, and you know that that's your precision, you need a certain length. And already, that length in that field with that precision decides that piece of the experiment. You need to do so well, or you feel you need for the physics. And then, of course, it's like a box. You just have to keep putting the other things around. We would have dearly loved to have built an apparatus a tenth the size, probably a tenth the cost. But once you start putting in how well you can measure some of these things and how well you need to know them, that starts to determine the parameters of the experiment. And that's really how the size grew. It wasn't just chosen to be big to impress or to spend a lot of money. It was just that we knew how well we could measure things, and that determined the size of the experiment. And it's true of the other experiments.
On your sketches of what you were explaining and projecting, you had a straight line, one going one way, one the other. There was no deviation from the 180 degrees. And yet in your little photographs of the colors that you took with your special equipment, there was a deviation from the straight line. Why?
Well,
you repeat the question.
It was asked that in the sort of illustrative sketches of the events, I had both things at 180 degrees, but in the pictures, they were deviated from 180 degrees. It's really just a geometrical trick, in a sense. The pictures that you saw were in the plane of the two particles coming in. So if you stood and looked at these two collisions, you would see them come in, and you would see this projection of the event. Now, what I was showing you, and there, you could have things that were not at 180 degrees. But now if I go around here and I look at the beams like this, in this plane, if I only have two particles, then they should be in a plane. But in the other view, they needn't be in a plane. And that's why you look in this transverse plane, in fact. So it's just momentum conservation and the way you look at it. It's confusing, but it's just the way I showed the picture. No, no, no. That's it's a slight public relations business. Yeah, the question was, I said there were 4,000 interactions per second. Were we taking data on all of them? And the answer is no, and that was one of the major problems in the experiment. That's the rate at which the antiproton and the proton interact. And of course, with an experiment like UA1, you cannot take data on all those collisions. We could take data at roughly one or two events per second. Now, to get down from 4,000 to one or two, you have to trigger the experiment. You have to be selective in real time. So you have your collision, and then you have to make a decision while the information is around. Should I take it or should I not take it? Should I wait for the next one? So it's the triggering of the experiment, which has to be selective. And of course, you have to do it in real time while the experiment is running. If you do it wrong, you will throw all this good physics away. But to answer your question, it's the way that you decide which events you record, which two per second that you record out of the 4,000, which really counts as the first step. And then you get these events from the two per second by analyzing them. But the first step, you've lost all the other events. You only take the two per second, and you have to make that decision at the time of the collision. And that was one of the difficult things on the experiment, one of the many difficult things.
Is it, or would it be available in biomedical physics?
Well,
is it, or would it be available for biomedical conditions?
Does it have anything to do with biophysics?
Could it be used?
No, I don't think so. Radiation, yes, is used for research in that area. The pions, for example, but not W's and Z's. I mean, no, they're too rare, too expensive, and they don't live for any length of time.
Yes?
What experiments are you planning in the next year or two?
Repeat the question for people.
I've been asked a very loaded question, actually. What experiments am I planning in the next year or two? Well, I divide my time right now between two things. I've known the Triumph Lab for many years. I have a lot of friends at Triumph. Triumph has established an international reputation. That's why I come here. Triumph has the possibility of adding, I mean, if you know Eric Vogt well, the flavors that he has at the moment, he has up and he has down. And in a sense, in his sort of ice cream parlor, he would like strange flavors down at Triumph, in actual fact. And so there are plans to build a Kaon factory. Now, there are a lot of good experiments you could do in a Kaon factory, but first the case has to be made. So that is one of my activities, to work hard on making this case for the Kaon factory. The other one, I have an interest in an experiment down at SLAC, which in fact, if they make a successful machine go, you could not only have a Z0 per week, you could have one maybe every 20 seconds. You could go and sit on it. And then you could do a lot of physics. Plus, of course, what I hope to do is to keep in touch with UA1 and do some analysis at the University of Victoria. So I have, in a sense, those three strings. And that's probably more than one person can manage anyway.
Question here. Can you bring us up to date on the results of the proton decay experiment?
Well, there are no convincing decays. What is the latest status of the proton decay experiment? I don't know it as of even a few months, but a few months ago at the meeting, there were no really convincing events, or a few candidate events. But of course, you have to convince the world that you're not seeing neutrino interactions. The limit on the lifetime is probably getting uncomfortably beyond 10 to the 30. It's probably getting towards 10 to the 31. But I suspect it will take years before those pieces of apparatus are understood. So there are two or three events in an Indian experiment, one or two events in a Japanese experiment. Some of the events are very close to the periphery of the detector. They're not in the heart of the detector, people don't like them very much. So I think there isn't really, as I know at this moment, a convincing proton decay. But there must be 10 experiments in the world to look for proton decay.
The question at the back.
Sorry, I don't think.
Could you hear that? You have different particles transferring force between like a weak interaction with a certain particle associated with them.
Yeah.
The strong interaction is also have a certain particle associated
with yes.
them. Yes. But the strong interactions are between quarks, aren't they?
Yes.
So when you need a different type of particle other than a particle made up of quarks to regulate that.
Yes, and that in fact is what I mentioned in. The question is, in the strong force, it's transmitted by particles. What is it that's transmitting the force between the quarks? Wouldn't you have a different kind of a particle? And in fact, you have what I mentioned in passing, the gluon, as it's called. This is the name that's been given to, and in fact, it's been a massless particle, and the coupling constant varies. And it's the gluon that transmits the force between the quarks. There are a lot of complexities in there. The quarks are given a quantity called color. There are three colors. There are gluons that carry color. And you have a color charge. It's an unfortunate nomenclature because it's got nothing to do with color as we understand it. But yes, and you have a gluon. The gluon is postulated. And in just the same way that you have seen quarks by their jets, you have, in fact, seen gluons in detectors. If you have an E plus E minus collision, it goes to a pair of quarks, and sometimes one of those quarks radiates a gluon. So you can have events where you have not just two jets, but a third jet that grows out of one of the two. And those events have convincingly been seen on the E plus E minus machine in Hamburg, on the Petra machine. So gluons have, in fact, in just the same way, been seen in the laboratory, but only by their decay products.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes?
I understand that to split up the smaller particles of the atom require more force than the larger particles. That is to split an atom into protons, neutrons, and it will take less force than to split the smaller particles of leptons or muons or whatever it is. Now, if we extend that to logical extremes, the smaller the particle, the greater the force, or the cohesive force is greater. That is why we are using a greater force to split the smaller the particle. Now, if the smaller the particle, the greater the force, and if we extend it to logical extremes, what happens or what will happen is that there will be no particle and there will be only force.
No, I think I think maybe I misled. I think the picture that I tried to give you in some sense was not so much the stronger the force, the smaller the particle. What I tried to show you was, in fact, that you needed higher energies, I think, was what I tried to, the idea that I tried to get across, to look at smaller and smaller distances. It's all connected, I don't know whether with the uncertainty principle. The fact that if you want to look at smaller and smaller dimensions, you have bigger and bigger uncertainty on the momentum. So I need more and more momentum to look at smaller and smaller distances. It's really the wavelength of the particle that counts when you come to probe into these things and see these particles. And to get the wavelength short, you have to have a high energy.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'll call on Dr. Volk, the director of TRIOMPS, to express our thanks.
We've got a great deal tonight to be thankful for Dr. Asprey's talk. The tradition of the Institute is to be devoted to ideas, and I think tonight was really in the finest tradition of the Institute. I think people here will have learned quite a few ideas. Perhaps you have far more questions than answers as a result of tonight's talk. But I think that's also a healthy thing, and I think something the Institute intends to do. Alan Asprey has tonight told us something about an experiment, something about the people involved, and something about the ideas and science involved. The experiment itself was a tour de force. It was an experiment like perhaps no other that will occur in physics in this generation, and like few others that have occurred in this century of science. It was perhaps 100 years ago when Maxwell united magnetic and electric force that we previously had such a unification, such a simplification, Dr. Schramm. And this simplification, I think, has come out of this particular experiment. And it will be, it's really a milestone in science. Alan Asprey was born in Liverpool at about the same time as the Beatles. And this particular experiment will be regarded as a milestone in science long after the Beatles have disappeared from folk memory. He's also told us a bit about the science. Now here, I'm sure there are many people who are puzzled. He's told you about all of the different kinds of quarks, the charmed quarks, the bottomless and bottom and topless quarks, and the guts and that sort of thing. You may wonder about those names, but if you were to abandon your wife and your children and your wife's mother for 6 years and go to a tunnel underneath CERN, you would start speaking like that too. And you might begin to think of these things in terms of young ladies on bicycles and that sort of thing. So perhaps he's given us a glimpse of that world of physics. Here there will be some simplifications. The Schramm syndrome about simplifying things is a long one. In the 13th century, when King Alfonso of Spain, Alfonso el Sabio, was taught the Ptolemaic system, he was a very devout man. And after learning it for 2 years, he thought he finally understood it. And he said that if the good Lord had asked him beforehand, he would have recommended something simpler. And something simpler will probably emerge. So this experiment and this work has had tremendous impact. People did not expect this experiment to find the W and the Z. And in fact, in the United States, at Brookhaven, people were building a $500 million accelerator to find the W and Z. That project was now canceled with $150 million spent on it. And one is going on now to build a much larger 100-mile accelerator to find the Higgs particles. Beyond them, of course, lies something which is a million billion times heavier yet called the X particle, which Charles wants to find. And that's going to be a very expensive thing to find. So for giving us a glimpse into all of these things, for giving us some ideas tonight about the science involved, about the people, and about the accelerators, and about an experiment which Alan and Carlo Rubbia were the co-leaders of, I think we owe him a great deal. And we also want to welcome him to Vancouver, to Victoria, and to Vancouver, which will now be their base. And we want to welcome all of the Aspreys to British Columbia. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, and good night.